Hello and welcome everyone to the LSE for this online event. My name is Chris Anderson. I'm a professor in European politics and policy here at the London School of Economics and Political Science. I have to say the political science bit because I am a political scientist. I'm very, very pleased to be here to welcome Justin Webb and Marcia Valenciano to the LSE today. Justin Webb, you probably know, he's a journalist and broadcaster, and most importantly, an alumnus of LSE. We were just speaking about it, where he, among other things, edited The Beaver. He's also, in a later life, a former BBC North America editor, and is a presenter on Today on BBC Radio 4. Marcia Valenciano is the founding director of Benjamin Franklin House here in London. She holds a PhD in economic history from the London School of Economics and Political Science as well. This event is the annual Robert H. Smith Family Foundation Lecture in Democracy, which aims to promote the importance of international diplomacy and democracy in the spirit of Benjamin Franklin as a diplomat and politician. Today, Justin and Marcia will be discussing American democracy and asking whether it is under threat, which is a question we probably wouldn't have dared to ask just a few years ago. For those Twitter users among you in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is LSE US Democracy. I'll say that again, LSE US Democracy, one word. This online event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. As usual, there will be a chance for you to put your questions to Justin and Marcia. To submit your questions, please use the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. Questions will be submitted to myself, and I will then pose as many of these to the speakers. Please let us know your name and affiliation. We're particularly keen to hear from our students, alumni, and incoming students, so please let us know. So this is my time to say I'm delighted to hand over to Justin and Marcia, who will now have a conversation. Welcome.
Thank you, Chris. And thank you, Justin, for agreeing to have this conversation.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you, Marcia and Chris.
Well, my first question is really about the question that you have posed. Is American democracy under threat, in your view?
Yes, it is. I don't think there's any real question about that. And it comes from two sources. One is the really obvious source that it is quite likely, and this is a sort of practical view of how things unfold in the next few years. It's quite likely that the Democrats will lose the House in the midterms. It's also quite likely in the next 2 to 4 years that they'll lose the Senate. And we can talk more about both of those things if we need to as the evening goes on. But assuming that were to happen, there would then be an election, a presidential election 2024, happening in a hostile environment in terms of Congress and what's going on in Washington when you think of the way the Supreme Court is already constituted. And in that hostile environment, it is entirely possible that Donald Trump stands. I don't think it's yet certain, but entirely possible, of course, and entirely possible either that he wins or that he does pretty well, and well enough for all the arguments about contesting various results in various states to become live again. And this time round, and here's the really important part of this time round, will the Republican election officials in crucial states still stand up to him in the way that some of them quite bravely did last time round? And will the efforts of John Eastman, his lawyer, and others to find ways to muddy the waters, to make life really difficult so that electoral college votes can't be certified, et cetera, et cetera. Will that reach a more successful conclusion the next time round? And does that then potentially subvert democracy in the sense that the election would be regarded as illegitimate by really large numbers of Americans and large numbers of their media supporters. And that, in a sense, is the undermining process. So that's one side of it. I think, though, and that's in a sense, that's the kind of obvious one, isn't it? It's the one we focus on and talk about. There is another side to it, though, that I think is possibly not equally worrying, but also worrying. And that is the way that the large swathes of the American left have gone down the road of believing things and saying things about their nation that fundamentally undermines, bluntly, its goodness, its rightness, its right to exist, its right to be constituted. There's a wonderful book by Richard Rorty, who's one of my favorite American philosophers and wrote very widely, not just political philosophy, but he wrote a book called Achieving Our Nation, probably 10, 20 years ago, in which, and I really recommend this book to anyone studying American politics. And he's from the left. He's absolutely on for what we now call lazily in the media woke things. So he believed in changes in the way that people were described. He believed passionately that large groups of people had been excluded in a way that they shouldn't have been excluded from public life, and particularly in universities. But, and there's a very big but, he also suggested that those on the left who believe that and also then regard it as a reason to delegitimize the whole enterprise were playing a very dangerous game. And what, and he's dead now, Rorty, and I think he would be horrified to see, for instance, with critical race theory, and you can say all you like that it's not a part of most schools in America, and of course it's not. It's not taught in Virginia schools, but it did play a part in the election. And it played a part in the election because a lot of Americans just don't think that, for instance, renaming Thomas Jefferson High School with another name is the right way to go. It says things about the nation that make them feel uncomfortable. And that kind of sense of questions being asked, not just about current politics, not just on the way to right racial wrongs, but also about the fundamental legitimacy of the whole structure, are also, it seems to me, potentially undermining of democracy from the left. So you have the practical, immediate attack from the right, but you also have this undermining sense on the left. And I think the two of those combining together can lead you to ask the question and probably answer it in the affirmative. But yes, there is a potential threat there, no doubt about it.
And this polarization between the left and the right that really reached a crescendo in the last election, I mean, you've given a good example with the author and the challenge of undermining from the left. Do you see that there was another course that might have led to a different outcome? So was it inevitable that there would have been this inability for both sides of the political aisle to speak to one another? Where if you go back in the time, say, of Ronald Reagan, there might have been great division in ideological viewpoints, but there was still this sense of an ability and almost a kindness, if you had opposing views, a kind of civil discourse that seemed to be missing in the last election.
And there, I wonder if one of the reasons, well, here are two causes of that potentially. One is what we call social media. It's not very social. But the way in which we have allowed ourselves via Facebook in particular, but via other channels as well, to become so filled with conflict and division, and to have, and there's no question about this, the algorithm that Facebook uses to have that division then increased right around the world, actually, it's fair to say, but also particularly in the United States. And I think there is a real, you know, that wasn't around in Reagan's time. And it's not the only story in town, but it does seem to me that the ability of people very quickly to not only develop an antagonism to the other side as they see it, but also then to organize very quickly. And you see that in the January the 6th attack on Congress, with people inside Facebook. We've just seen all of the information brought out by the whistleblower. It's fascinating to read the internal documentation of people inside Facebook already worried in the days up to January the 6th about the degree to which people were just able, with the Stop the Steal slogan, to get themselves together, to organize. None of that stuff, of course, existed in yesteryear, and by yesteryear, I suppose I mean 10 years or so ago. So I think that is part of it. I also think, though, there's a kind of political analysis that looks at inequality. And for all that Reagan supercharged so many aspects of American capitalism, the kind of inequality that you see now just wasn't around then. Evan Osnos, who writes now, I think, for The New Yorker, does he? Anyway, Evan Osnos, the author, again, well worth looking at his most recent works, in which he sets out how individual towns, individual cities, not the big ones, but small ones, have become kind of physically divided. People have literally built walls around their property. So it's not just a sort of social media phenomenon, it's actually a physical phenomenon on American streets, the ability of people to move away from each other, to move, number one, to a place where everyone else kind of is the same as you, but number two, then, to put walls around that place has been enormously, enormously enhanced in recent times. And Osnos suggests, I think quite convincingly, that a lot of that is to do with the inequality that happened after, actually in the years since 9/11, he argues, the kind of security state apparatus that came up and made a lot of people very rich, but left a lot of people further behind, and then obviously made worse by the financial crisis, that there is this kind of underlying anger at, you know, what people call the death of the American dream. There's a sense that actually you can't get on, particularly for what Americans call middle-class Americans, what we in Britain would call working-class Americans, this kind of sense in which you can't, whatever you do, break out and do the kind of things that you once regarded as just quintessentially American. Now, to an extent, I think that was probably always a bit of a myth, but you know, that sort of sense, that myth that you can sign up to and believe in is also not there. So that has the added impact, it seems to me, of causing Americans then to look at what it is that is upsetting, or to try to find reasons for why they're so upset, and to turn on each other. So, you know, social media inequality, I think there are probably other things as well, but a range of causes that have led us to this.
This may also be a demographic issue, right? That, you know, the complexion of the United States has changed from what it was in the 1950s, in the 1960s, you might say in the 1970s, where there was always a sense, you know, give us, you're poor, you're hungry. You know, my family were immigrants to the United States. So we all have a story of our heritage, and people are very proud of that. But America as a white America is not, you know, really what the nation is comprised of today. There is a lot more diversity. So how much of the discontent is almost a reactionary result of a wanting to look back to the America that was, as opposed to the America that is today?
Yeah, I think there's unquestionably part of that is true. Although, of course, you know, the sense of whether or not America has the right immigration is, it seems to me, a reasonable subject for discussion. So you know, I can't remember who it was who wrote about this, but there's a fascinating series of pieces about it a year or two ago, the sense in which it is not enough simply to say America was once open to immigrants, including very poor immigrants, and now suddenly isn't. America needed poor immigrants at a time that it was open to them, so the argument goes. So if you look at the kind of early part of the 20th century, actually, who did they need? Well, they needed kind of muscle, and they needed women to work in the warehouse factories and all the rest of it. They needed this kind of the American immigration wasn't quite as kind of, oh, just send us anyone and it's fine, as is sometimes made out. It actually was very useful to the United States at the same time. And so the argument then goes, well, hang on a second, look at now. What do you need now? You need computer programmers. You need people, you need educated people, because there aren't an awful lot of manual jobs. And yet what you get, because of the way that immigration is currently structured and because of illegal immigration as well from South America, you don't get those people. You get different people. And you don't have to go full Trump by any means, but you do have to say, you know, it is a legitimate question to ask whether, and it's not just white Americans actually, but those Americans who are full Americans, including particularly Hispanics, are not perfectly legitimately asking questions about who is allowed into America and how you become American. And I speak as the father of an American citizen who is a US citizen. My daughter just got a new passport today, a full citizen because she was born there, which is, I mean, to me, wonderful. And I don't think it's ever going to go. And Trump toyed with the idea of finding a way of getting rid of birthright citizenship, but it would be so difficult to do that eventually, among many other things, he forgot about it. But, you know, I think it's perfectly legitimate to have a discussion about who future Americans should be. But what is not so legitimate, and what I think you're hinting at, is that there is also this kind of just this fear of being sunk by people who are going to metropolitan America, who are changing the culture of the nation, who are increasingly celebrated as Americans. And if you're stuck in the middle of nowhere and your kids are hooked on fentanyl, you're not going to feel good about it. And there is unquestionably that side of modern America has increased the anger, has increased, as Obama said all those years ago before he was elected, and he made some rather unwise, unguarded remarks at a fundraiser to the effect that people go back to their religion and their guns, etc. There is, you do go back to kind of basics when you are stuck in the middle of nowhere and you feel that the whole of your nation has passed you by. And one of the big challenges, it seems to me, if democracy in America is going to be rescued, is somehow a way of including people in a sense, in spite of what they feel, in spite of who they are, but because they're Americans, including people and making sure that they are involved. And there you come to this terrible business of the Republican Democrat split at the moment in the country, and the fact as it is that increasingly Democrats don't represent these people and don't represent their areas. And that is another reason, I think, we might go into this in a bit more detail, why American democracy is threatened, because of the way that the two big parties are incapable of dealing with the kind of demographic voting split that there now is.
Mm. And lots of gerrymandering to create ideal districts, you know, depending on, again, what seems optimal, you know, based on what your political persuasion is. But you mentioned Obama, and it seems like a auspicious day to mention him, given I saw a headline on the BBC that he arrived in Glasgow for the COP26 climate talks to great fanfare, because you have written that the Obama presidency did not quite live up to its potential, and said that it laid the groundwork for the Trump years. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, so two things, really. Number one, and I think a lot of Democrats, well, I know a lot of Democrats believe this to be the case, and it's perfectly publicly known now. They feel that the first couple of years of the Obama administration, the first administration, were wasted. And there was too much emphasis on bipartisanship that realistically was never there. It was a naivety, actually, not just Obama, but on the behalf of his advisors as well. And they should have gone for broke on healthcare. They should have gone much further on the size of the package that rescued America from the financial crisis. They should also have gone much further. And in various other things, they should have done more. They trusted their opponents more than they really legitimately should have done. So that's kind of one side of it. There are two other wider sides of it. There is a sense in which the Obama administration, I think, for all the extraordinary, I mean, staggering achievement in getting in there, were too much fixed on the kind of old, almost Clintonian way of doing things and weren't properly looking at post-financial crisis, the kind of almost revolutionary change that Americans on left and right felt was needed. So, you know, when you talk about the closing down of the American dream, when you talk about, you look at the extraordinary rise in drug taking, particularly in the kind of white working class areas, rural areas, you look at the fentanyl prevalence in the latter part, particularly of his second term. You look at all those things that were causing upset and division, and yet you look at the Obama people flowing easily between the Obama White House and Amazon and Uber and all the other kind of pleasant places that there were to work, and you, I think, can legitimately raise the question of just how much was this man and this administration willing to say, as to an extent Biden has said, my God, we got some big changes to focus on here, like the minimum wage, like reaching out to people who've genuinely been left behind, like providing family leave, like all these kind of things that actually aren't necessarily left-right, actually, but do address real issues in people's lives. And I think there is a legitimate way in which you could say Obama didn't do those things. And then the final one is actually a kind of nerdy political one, but he let the party structure fall apart around the nation. It was very much, again, you know, God love him, as Biden would say, had a lot on his plate, and also he was who he was, and that in a sense was another thing on his plate, but if you look at the way he left the party at the end of the second term, it was pretty hollowed out, not firing on all cylinders by any means, and I mean at the kind of state level. Ability to win state delegates to state legislatures, the number of governors, the kind of structure, the kind of enthusiasm, they took their eye off the ball. So I think for all of those reasons, the Obama administration set the tone then for Trump and set the tone for the kind of objections to the Democrats that then were seized on by the right-wing press and by Fox News, etc., in the run-up to the Clinton loss. So it's an interesting one. There is, you know, you look back at 2015, and it is fair to say that nobody really thought that Trump could win. No serious person did. Well, except actually Keith Ellison, who serious students of American politics might remember. In fact, I think he still has office in the Democratic Party. But he was Keith Ellison. Yeah, I think he's possibly still in the legal framework in Minnesota. But anyway, Keith Ellison, who was a congressman in those days, in fact, he was America's first Muslim congressman. And I knew him a bit when I was based out there. And he warned that it was possible that Trump would win, did it famously on one of those Sunday morning TV shows. And everyone laughed. I mean, all the other people on the thing laughed and said, you don't really believe that seriously. So one or two people saw Trump coming, but most people didn't. I think, you know, it's fair to say that you can't blame the Obama administration for not realizing that Trump was around the corner. And I'm certainly not doing that. But I do think in some of the things that they didn't do, some of the sins of omission did lead to, well, plainly to the situation that there was that Trump could capitalize on.
So I want to switch gears a little bit and ask you about the so-called special relationship between Britain and America, which has been variously described as essential, and most recently by our Prime Minister, indestructible. So what do you think is the current state of affairs? And I'm mindful that the UK has done quite well in benefiting from the AUKUS security agreement. Yet a trade deal with the US does not necessarily appear imminent. And in the words of the Prime Minister, he says that the Americans do negotiate very hard. So that's maybe hedging his bets against getting the US negotiators around the table and getting a trade deal that would be favorable to the UK.
When I went to see I can't say who it was because they do all these things on deep background. My last day in the White House, I went to see a senior administration official. This is of the Obama administration, newly elected. And I asked them why they'd got rid of the bust of Winston Churchill that was in the Bush White House. I said, why did you do that? Your most ancient ally, special relationship and all that. And he said, we thought it was Eisenhower. He said, well, one white guy looks much like another to us. And he was kind of only half joking, actually. It was this kind of sense of, I don't know, you people are obsessed with your own relationship, and we're just not. We're interested in other things. And I think all sensible British politicians behind the scenes, I know this to be the case, and ambassadors to roll their eyes when anyone talks of the special relationship and think it's just complete nonsense. It's a sort of newspaper thing. So I just basically don't think it exists. I think we get on extremely well on occasions. You look at Tony Blair and George W. Bush, and obviously Reagan and Thatcher as well, but you still have your differences. And there is also a realistic assessment of British power and the usefulness of the United Kingdom to the various things that America wants to do. And I think while there is a genuine respect actually for our, I've been in a previous life, I was a war correspondent, and I was in the first Gulf War, and I saw, you know, US and UK forces close together. And there is particularly a level of special forces, there's a respect there, but I think there's also a full understanding in the United States that Britain is not a great power and is not able to project power and is not massively useful. We've just sent an aircraft carrier to China. Well, not to China, but around China. I'm not sure whether really the United States actually feels that that's the best use of American. I mean, certainly my friends who work in the Pentagon rolled their eyes at that. So really, what's the point? You'd be much better off you sorting things out in Europe, actually. There's a lot of work, a lot of soft power work to be done that Britain is good at, or has been historically good at, rather than sending one aircraft carrier to the South China Sea. So there is this, I think there's quite a hard-headed realism in the United States about it. I always felt that there was, albeit that, you know, they like the English accent. I spent a lot of my time impersonating Hugh Grant when I was there, but I don't think fundamentally that actually leads to anything much when it comes to hard politics. And, you know, to follow up what you were saying about the trade agreement, look, are we willing to allow American big pharma and American big agriculture into UK markets or not? And in the case of pharma, are we willing to pay the kind of prices that you pay in America for stuff? No, we're not. Do we want our pharma industry dominated by our agricultural industry dominated by your big agricultural companies with your agricultural practices? No, we don't. And it seems to me that in those circumstances, I can't understand how it would be possible that a trade deal could be signed. So, when it comes to the special relationship, I think it's a thing in the papers, but not much more than that.
Although it can be very personal as somebody who's a proud American citizen, but also a very proud British subject. But I appreciate that you have been very forthright in your remarks this evening. And I wonder how you tread that line between what you need to do on the Today Show or, you know, throughout your career as a journalist to be impartial. And a lot of discussion, hasn't there been in recent years, about the impartiality of the BBC or lack of it, because you're very good at holding all sides to account, but yet you are able to express your views, for example, in your writing, which I recommend to our listeners. Is that a hard dichotomy to maintain?
To be honest, it's not as hard as it seems to people who are themselves partial. So you go into the BBC wanting to be impartial, not because you're pathetic and lily-livered and on the one hand, on the other hand, but actually almost the opposite, because you want to try to get at what truths might be, but you're bright enough to understand that there is no one truth when you're talking about political things. And what you're looking at then is a judgment of what seems to be the case. And if you like doing that, if you're interested in judgment, just as the best of academia is interested in making judgments about stuff, not just sort of propagandizing or trying to undermine some opponent. There's a place for that, and there are some wonderful columnists who have great opinions on this, that, or the other. But I've managed to write, and the BBC has been happy for me to write, because I write from the standpoint, I write the same kind of things that I would have written for From Our Own Correspondent on BBC Radio, or that you would write currently in a kind of introduction to a piece, where you do try to deal with what you believe on the basis of evidenced judgment to be the case. What you wouldn't hear me say is, you know, I think the Democrats are wonderful, or I think Trump's great, or I think, because, I mean, number one, it's boring. I mean, there's thousands of people doing that now on social media, but also on broadcast channels as well around, obviously in the United States, but to an increasing extent, perhaps here in Britain as well. But in a way, it's so easy and it's so unsatisfying. And that doesn't mean, of course, you don't occasionally get it wrong. And you know, there are dangers, but I very much hope, and I know that the BBC's view is that impartiality is a thing worth hanging on to, but it's not a negative reducing thing. It's something that actually allows you to grapple with stuff, but you must be open. You must be open to correcting your judgment if the evidence seems otherwise. And it must be a kind of interrogative thing rather than a didactic, just announcing stuff. But I think, you know, it is interesting that, you know, we're having a discussion now in the United Kingdom about how we do organize our media. How do we think about the way in which we discuss events, and we look across at the United States, and frankly, we don't think much of it. We are quite worried by, and again, you know, I don't want to be too kind of on the one hand, on the other hand, having just suggested no, but it's not just Fox News, it's almost MSNBC as well, on the left in the United States. You just think, what is the point of people constantly stringing a line, telling you things, telling an audience things that they probably already believe? That's hopeless. We don't want to do that.
I don't know what happened then.
Okay.
Yes. Well, sorry about that.
You were just saying that it's kind of boring if you're just telling people what they already believe and not giving alternative perspectives so that people can widen their opinions.
But also challenging their perspectives. and challenging them widely, so occasionally annoying absolutely everyone. Or at least, I mean, annoying is probably too strong a word, but challenging absolutely everyone, challenging people's views of what they regard to be true. And, you know, look, most people still want that. I refuse to believe that people have become so kind of intellectually small that they want just to have stuff that they already agree with splurging out from a TV or from a radio. I don't think that's the case. I think they do want to engage. And that's the opportunity for people like me to have an opportunity still to talk about what seems to be the case in various aspects of the world. And you look at it with the BBC's political editor, with Laura Koonsberg, who has a really, I mean, you know, puts makes my job looks very easy indeed. And I talk about the United States and only about the United States, which of course, you know, is not germane to most people's daily experience of life in Britain. It's slightly on one remove, but you look at having a political editor and that task, and all the ways in which you could reduce the role so that you say absolutely nothing at all, and how sad that would be. We do need to be able to make judgments and to say things. There's no question at all about that. And impartiality doesn't stop you.
Well, I've got two questions, my two final questions that I'm going to roll up together so that we can quickly get to the questions that Chris will field from the listeners. And one is a quote that comes from something you wrote recently. And the other is about Benjamin Franklin. So let me just put the Benjamin Franklin question out there. Mm. What do you think he would make of US affairs today? But the quote is the following. It will not have escaped your notice that the place is troubled, writing about the US. It's even possible that it's doomed by a political system that has run out of rope and a culture that no longer acknowledges common purpose, even common humanity. Above all, a culture in which forgiveness and atonement have been abandoned. Mm. That is a pretty bleak outlook. So I wanted to ask you where the green shoots support.
Yeah, and that's possibly where Benjamin Franklin comes in too, because I think he would see them. That just starting with that quote, I was kind of in a sense echoing what I thought Richard Rorty would feel about the way the direction of travel now, and the question of atonement, I think, is really important. Actually, it seems to me that there is an unforgiving nature to American discourse that is genuinely troubling, and a sense, a really deep sense, that those with whom Americans disagree are illegitimate and not just wrong, but the enemy. And that, I think, is part of it, and goes really to the context of what we were talking about right at the beginning, the way in which at the next presidential election you could see an actual challenge, you know, with potentially the army involved and potentially armed militias and all sorts of awful things happening, and all the time on the other side from the left, this kind of sense that anyone who wasn't on board for the truths that they want to hold to was also illegitimate. And in that sense, you see it all falling apart. So I think that's the dismal side of it. The less dismal side, the positive side, is this, that this has been, goodness knows, I'm not an American historian by any manner of means, but throughout its history, it has been through, it had a civil war, you know, an actual civil war. It's been through the most appalling traumas. Look at the way it treated black people for most of its history. look at the way, look at poverty, look at Steinbeck, you know, go back into the various crises and disasters and unfairnesses. Look at the internment of the Japanese at the outset of the Second World War. Look at all the awful things. Look at all the assassinations in the 60s and people being beaten over the head by a very over-aggressive police at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. I mean, you've got so many echoes, actually, of horror. And yet, not only has it survived is a weedy word to use, it's prospered. It's become easily the world's preeminent power. But also, more importantly, culturally, the place that everyone actually still really, really deep in their hearts would like to move to. People aren't queuing up to move to China or to Saudi Arabia or to Russia. They're queuing to move to the European Union, but only because it's kind of close, I suspect. Most people still who are around the world who are poorer and who want to make something of their lives or have their children make something of their lives see America still at the top, and that's for a reason, and those reasons haven't completely gone. So I think there is still a huge reason never to bet against the United States of America in the long term. And I think it's also the case that these derangements, and I'm thinking now of QAnon and all this kind of nonsense, horrific conspiracy theories that have gripped large segments of America, and it's fair to say large segments of the Republican Party, which actually is something we didn't really go into earlier on, but there is also, among the many threats to democracy, we should be clear that there are there is a substantial number of Republican Party supporters who seem to have completely taken leave of their senses when it comes to democracy, and actually rather taken leave of support for democracy as a thing. So all of this stuff. But you know, you look back to the 60s, you look back to the hippie era where people wanted to do their own thing and tune out of American life and didn't actually think much about democracy. Hippie, that kind of the 60s were not a period where you thought about or wanted to be democratically controlled. They were an era where you believed you had the right to believe what you want and do what you want. And that kind of sense of America always being on the cusp of being a bit crazy, I think is not actually a recent one. You look back to Buffalo Bill. I was reading a very good book the other day. I can't remember who wrote it, about Buffalo Bill. And this kind of sense in which one is on the one is a mythical character. On the other hand, he was very real. On the one hand, he had Native Americans in his stage show. On the other hand, he actually killed them. And there's this kind of weird sort of way in which the United States has always mixed up truth and reality and show business, and it's been part of a kind of rich, heady, occasionally disastrous brew right throughout its history. And so you could say, if you took a longer historical view, well, it's just one of those periods. They'll get over this. They'll get out of it. And I certainly, you know, from me personally, and I say this on the basis not of huge judgment, but as you say, Marcia, as a kind of, you know, emotional thing. My daughter is a US citizen, and I she's immensely proud to be American. And I love the fact that, you know, so many Americans I know are so wonderful, and the place in so many respects is so wonderful. And I find it difficult to believe, actually, that something with so much going for it, particularly youth, actually, and that kind of sense of enormous potential, and for all that some white people, as we were saying earlier, might feel discombobulated, to put it mildly, God, I mean, just the potential, the way in which America has this ability to reinvent itself, and may now reinvent itself, actually, as a kind of largely Hispanic nation in the longer term future is extraordinary. And I think, you know, it does suggest to those of us who write those rather dismal sentences, as I wrote that one, that there is another way, and it's entirely possible that that other way could come to pass.
On that really interesting note, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to thank you for the discussion so far and the conversation, which has been super interesting. What I want to do is take the remaining few minutes to open the floor to questions from our audience. And so please, if you have questions, type them in the Q&A box and give us your name and affiliation if you so wish. We already have a couple, and maybe I can, I think there's a comment from Susan Wolf, and then there's a couple of questions already. Susan mentions that Americans didn't need walls around neighborhoods in previous and relatively recent years, in part because there were laws on the books that created de facto segregation, preventing people from selling homes in areas of town to certain groups throughout America. So that was an interesting historical intervention. And that, of course, there have been other waves of immigration to the United States that weren't just about providing muscle for building, but of course, if you think about East European Jews emigrating in the early 20th century, who sought freedoms, perhaps, and opportunities that were denied them in Europe. But I think we can take those corrections. Anthony Valion asks a question about whether democracy can really work when the winning party in each state via their governorship makes the rules and election process, plus then can gerrymander the boundaries. Surely you have to have one set of rules for the whole country with a neutral election body setting and monitoring the rules, like in most democracies. And this kind of goes a little bit maybe to your point about the Republicans now perhaps trying to use state electoral institutions to get ready for 2024 and what may be to come. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, very much so. I think it's a really important, and it's difficult for anything but the most serious papers to write about because they feel that it's not interesting and it's a bit nerdy and all the rest of it. But actually gerrymandering and the independence of election officials, you think what happened in Georgia, you think of the few, and it's not just in Georgia, there's a couple of other places too, where Republican officials were pretty brave, actually. Even those who didn't get a direct call from the president, a threatening call from the president, but there were some others as well who had quite a tough time. And the risk, obviously, is that they're not in place next time round, that local Republican parties have got rid of them. It is also the case that the gerrymandering of House seats is, well, you look at what's going on at the moment in Ohio as well, worth having a look at the situation in Ohio. It's just the most extraordinary, just bizarre looking districts being carved out in order to create a massive, they've already got a majority, and they're all a massive Republican House majority. And those sorts of things, those sort of basic electoral things are, it seems to me, part and parcel of what an ideal Biden administration would manage to sort during two administrations. The problem, of course, is that it's entirely possible they don't get to a second administration, and that they are so subsumed with other problems that actually this isn't going to be it. They've also got to sort out the Senate. And that's a more complicated one because it seems to me that actually the rural-urban split wasn't much of a problem when the Democrats and the Republicans were each of them competing for rural votes. And you could have a situation where the Democrats were doing perfectly well in, I don't know, Montana or Idaho or somewhere. And it didn't terribly matter that there was a split in opinion because the parties themselves were so much more heterogeneous. But now that's not the case. And so the urban-rural split has become ossified along party lines, and that is a real danger. And you know, getting around that, finding a way to sort out the Senate, possibly adding DC, possibly finding other ways of making it fairer and making it more representative is a pretty urgent thing. It's a pretty dry thing. It doesn't drive most people into politics, but those sort of basic fundamental reforms are, it seems to me, very much, well, they have to be. They obviously are on the agenda of some Democrats who are very exercised by them, but getting it done, getting it actually through is an enormous job of work. But I agree, a really vital one.
I was just going to add that it's also an interesting juxtaposition to look at the role of the judiciary, because we see a conservative Supreme Court, but a number of challenges that have been raised most recently with Biden's proposal that workers who are employed by a company with over 100 employees must be vaccinated in order to continue working in the new year, or in the situation in Texas with a state decision to basically overturn Roe versus Wade, and you know whether that can hold up in the courts. So, you know, depending on what side, again, of the political aisle you're on, I think it's a quite interesting dynamic to look at, you know, the role of an independent judiciary in some of these debates.
Yeah, and the extent to which the Supreme Court is going to go for broke. You know, it was interesting that they stepped aside from the Trump effort to delegitimize the election, but you know, it's a fact. My dog has just joined us. I hope we won't bark at any of them. But when you look at John Eastman, who spoke at that Trump rally just before the January the 6th events, who is now still actually in many respects allowed to be part of America's national debate. I think he still gives lectures. I think he still goes to kind of august institutions, and you know, can America cope with all of that? Is that sort of part of the judicial mix or not? And does the Roberts Court just go in a direction that I think Roberts would not want it to go, and start to be itself a kind of radical body? I think it's fair to say at the moment we don't know, but the abortion thing is interesting, isn't it? And it's actually not the Texas case that they're going to hear. It's another one. I think it's a Mississippi case, isn't it? They're going to have to decide by the middle of next year. And that will give us a clue of how radical they're going to be, and whether that then adds to this kind of sense of roiling threat to democracy, but a threat to democracy that comes from illegitimacy or from the delegitimizing in the eyes of many Americans of various institutions. And that's certainly a potential thing.
There's several more very interesting questions here. So let's maybe shift gears a tiny bit. I want to get back to populism and Trump and all that good stuff in a second, but there was an early question from Saqib Wani, and I hope I didn't butcher your name just now, who asks, what would be an ideal immigration policy to help reduce the growing hatred and xenophobia? That's a big question. That's a tough subject.
It's a big question. I mean, it seems to me that David Frum writes interestingly about this, and I'm going to dodge it and put you on to Frum, who wrote a series of pieces for The Atlantic, I think actually a year or so ago now, possibly even longer than that. So the former Bush speechwriter, kind of center-right intellectual, who has thought a lot about immigration. And I think has come up with some quite interesting questions, at least, about what future American immigration policy should be. And it's certainly not going down the kind of nativist line in any way, shape or form, but it is seizing the right, which after all, most countries do have, certainly in Britain, Australia, et cetera, Canada, to be a bit picky about what you do as an immigration policy, and to accept that it is your business to decide on what is best for the nation. And I think that's got to be the kind of starting point where everyone understands this is going to be open, it's going to be humane, it's absolutely not going to pander to racism or xenophobia, but it is going to be based on what we as Americans of all colors and creeds think is good for our nation. So in other words, it's a kind of more open conversation. I think that's the place to start. And I do recommend that what David Frum's written.
Great suggestions for our audience members. Christoph Ellersik from Sweden is asking a question about Trump. Trump isn't really going away. The mentions of Trump in the media have declined, obviously, since Joe Biden has taken office. But He is coming back, it looks like. It looks like there's going to be a crescendo of Trump news coming up. He's asking, do you, Justin, think that the Republicans would nominate Trump again? And or is his way to power perhaps outside of the Republican Party, in his own party and movement, away from?
That's such a good question. I mean, the honest answer, I have the foggiest idea, and I don't think anyone can have at the moment, because I think there are too many variables. And number one, two big ones: his health, which actually seems pretty robust, but you know, he's getting on a bit. Has he really got what it takes to do another campaign? Number two, though, the legal jeopardy that he's in, and again, it's a bit open. It's state based. It's New York State. There are potential legal threats that he faces that are very serious, to do with allegations of tax fraud, that basically he hugely reduced the value of buildings when he was reporting them to the IRS, but hugely increased that value when he was seeking loans for them, and then the differential between those two things is not acceptable and potentially illegal. And that, you know, that also could mire him in all sorts of difficulties when it came to the next primary. I also do think that a kind of younger, fresher Trump might well challenge him on the right. I mean, I don't think we've necessarily seen the end of Trumpism, even if we've seen the end of Trump. So I think it's a really interesting question. I just don't think you can know at this stage. But there is plainly a threat to the Republican Party. You know, whether it's a threat or not to America, I don't know. And I'm not suggesting one way or the other, but a threat to the Republican Party, that those Republicans who want to be shot of him and who want to include his populism, for instance, on reducing the price of pharmaceutical medicines, all these things that he never really got anywhere with, but actually were quite appealing and are perfectly decent things to want to do. If someone could run with that, it would be interesting. And I think they could then do very well in the Republican primary. So yeah, Trumpism, but not necessarily him.
Interesting, because I was thinking also of the recent election in Virginia to the governorship, where you had a Republican win state after Biden had won it by 10 points. And the question in my mind is, does that tell us anything about the kind of Republican who can do well, even if he's not very explicitly running on Trump's coattails?
Yeah. And I mean, and it's a really interesting with young King. I do think that the Virginia vote and the fact that the Democrats did so badly in rural areas, but much more worryingly for them, did pretty poorly in suburban areas, the kind of places that traditionally has made Virginia kind of Democratic state in recent years, is a worry for them. And was that because the Republican candidate kind of was quite careful to run away from Trump in those areas and did it quite successfully? And when it came to it nationally, if it were Trump who were running, he couldn't run away from Trump. And you might then find it much easier in a way for the Democrats to pull back their support and to win.
There's a question here from Kevin Agnew that kind of piggybacks on that. I'm mindful of the time, that we're a tiny bit after 6 o'clock. I want to pick a couple more questions, perhaps with your permission, and we'll close it out. Kevin asks provocatively, is it a bad thing if rural voters in the US have a stronger voice compared to the urban elite? What's so terrible about them?
Yeah, I really agree with that question, actually. I think it's, and you say provocatively, part of America is this balance between the metropolitan, the young, and the rural and the old. And there's absolutely nothing wrong, it seems to me, with arguing strongly for the balance that exists at the moment to be kept to, provided that you can do it in a way that it doesn't divide on party lines. I think that's the problem. It's absolutely part of America. And you think of the myth, the kind of sense of America is about Main Street in a small town. Every politician in American history has run against Washington. There's this kind of, it's an important sense in all Americans' hearts, including many Americans who live in New York City and never been outside Manhattan. The kind of wonderfulness of small town America. And it's a real thing. And if you lose that, you lose an awful lot. You know, if the place was run, so if you got rid of the Electoral College, for instance, and just ran in the big states and ran the whole thing from Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York and Chicago and the rest of it, you would lose absolutely. I agree with the thinking behind that question. I think you lose something. The problem is where the balance is. And I think to a lot of Americans, particularly the Americans who live in parts of the nation where the money is made, where the commerce is done, where the industry is based, they're just a little bit sick of the idea that they're being held back, hectored, having their right to abortions, their right to all sorts of things that they regard as really basic rights, hampered by people who, in their view, don't do very much to make America what it is. That's the balance that you've got to sort out. But I think the fundamental point of your question is a good one.
Well, and it's also interesting when you think about somebody like Elon Musk deciding to move his headquarters from California, maybe not so much around some of the issues that we've been talking about, but for freedom to conduct his business in the way that he feels that will be less encroached upon than California. But if you look at the electoral map, the winning map for 2020, and then the one that was there in 2016, which was a Trump win, there's still huge swathes of rural America that maybe does cling to this view of, you know, a very different America from the urban centers, you know, Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, Utah, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, et cetera, where, you know, those are very much red states. So I think that if you're a Democrat and a Democratic pollster, you know, how do you run well? Can you do that in some of those rural areas? That those are questions.
That then gets to policy issues, doesn't it? And for the Democrats, and some very big questions about the kind of policies that they have, and the fact that they were able to appeal to those people relatively recently. And a lot of it is social things, and it would require them to go to in a kind of the reverse of the direction that they have been recently. And I think for a lot of Democrats, they will feel they're just not willing to do that. I can't remember his name, but I remember interviewing the governor of Montana, who was a Democrat when I was the correspondent out there, and I asked him if he's in favor of gun control, and he said, "Yeah, I am. Gun control to me is shooting straight and hitting your target." And I think he'd used that line a lot before, but it was really brilliant. It was interesting because to an English audience, who expect Democrats to be kind of anti-guns in the sort of broad, he absolutely wasn't at all. Can the Democrats still come up with people like that who believe those things? Do they want to? A lot of Democrats would say, "Well, we've left all that behind." But the problem is that the corollary of leaving it behind is that you then leave, as you say, Montana behind or Idaho, wherever, and that's a problem.
So maybe we can close the discussion on a question from an LSE student. We have an LSE student from California, which I think is sort of a nice combination here, the sweet spot. Tyler Johnson asks, how should the U.S. deal with foreign interference in the election and build more trust in the legitimacy of election processes? And this goes back to the original topic of conversation, really, the future of American democracy. Elections are the central mechanism by which Americans select their leaders and govern themselves, but others are playing too these days. So what to do about it?
Can I refer you then to a much wiser person than me, Anne Applebaum, the writer for, all sorts of places, The Atlantic and The Washington Post as well, wrote a really interesting piece a year or so ago, in which she dealt with this issue of how do you bring round the crazies? So I'm talking about people who just believe things that are flatly not true, and quite often placed in their minds by Russians, not necessarily the Russian state, but by these kind of terrible farms of people spewing out disinformation across the world. How do you bring them back? And her argument was, I thought it was really striking, don't argue with them. It's a waste of time. Don't give them information. It's a waste of time. They're beyond it. They'll just, you know, they say, oh, it comes from the BBC. Well, we all know what the BBC, I mean, you cannot have those arguments, those discussions. Comes from the, you know, an LSE academic. Well, we all know what you have to do, Anne Applebaum suggested in this piece, I think it was for The Atlantic, was you just have to make sure the roads are well built and the schools are decently funded. And all the basic things in life, minimum wages are high, jobs are available, progress can be made in small communities. You bring people back one brick at a time by making life more decent for them and by giving them then a cause to adhere to the reality world rather than the crazed world. So that in a sense, it doesn't sound like an enormously practical way of getting them back in time for the next election. And frankly, I don't think it is. But her very strong argument was that the idea of anything on a kind of grand scale, a kind of retaking of their minds back from this disinformation, foreign disinformation, is just unrealistic. What you've got to do is make sure that you build the nation itself in a way that is attractive to them and attractive to everyone. And then it just dissipates this madness. That is her hope and her belief. And I've not seen anything more convincing, I must say.
Very interesting. That sounds a little bit like Infrastructure Week to me.
Yeah, an Infrastructure Week that actually happens, Chris.
That actually happens. I think we're gonna end on that note. And I just wanted to take a moment to thank everyone for being here and for listening, but especially thank Marcia and Justin for having this really, really interesting conversation tonight. Thanks to everyone for spending precious time with us. I know everyone's very, very busy these days. So I really appreciate everyone could make it. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.